unsurpassed, penetrating and perfect dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning.
Morning.
Happy to see all of you here. My name is Dave Rutschman, aka Dave Rutschman Beiler. Sometimes use this long hyphenated name. And I am a practitioner here at the Berkeley Zen Center. And increasingly, these last weeks, I've been feeling how valuable it is, how important it is, how precious it is, what we're doing here, what we're doing together at the Berkeley Zen Center and at places like the Berkeley Zen Center. I think the opportunity that we have to practice together in this way, more and more I'm feeling how much it matters. You know, how much it matters that we're doing this, that we get to do this together. This great shared undertaking, this great task, is really vital. And I've been feeling that more and more. I have a quote I thought I would read from the great Blanche Hartman. Blanche Hartman Diosho. Many of you knew Blanche. She was the first woman to be the abbot. She was a co-abbess at the San Francisco Zen Center, an original student of Suzuki Roshi's. Started practice actually here, not in this building, but at what was then called the Berkeley Zendo, I believe. So this is a quote. This is a quote from Blanche. I said, "My life depends on all the lives around me. We all support each other. None of us could take care of ourselves in a world all alone. We're so completely interwoven and interdependent. Our life depends on one another. And as you begin to realize that, you can't help but be grateful. My life depends on all the lives around me. We all support each other. None of us could take care of ourselves in a world all alone. We're so completely interwoven and interdependent. Our life depends on one another. And as you begin to realize that, you can't help but be grateful." So I think maybe that's it a little. I'm connecting to the gratitude for what we get to do together and that we get to do it together. That's a piece of what I'm feeling. I think the other piece is the backdrop, is the sort of larger context of our culture and our time. I think there's a pretty palpable sense, you know, of these powerful currents of recklessness and of cruelty in the culture. You know, you see it in the scapegoating and demonization of immigrants, the attacks on the rights and dignity of trans people. You see it in all these hundreds now, you know, of examples of this sort of weaponized greed, hate, delusion. You know? And against that backdrop, the specialness of what it is that we're doing, for me at least, becomes more and more and more clear. In a way, what we're doing together, if you zoom out enough, is we're working to create a culture of wisdom and compassion. That's what we're up to. That's what we're doing together. You know? So I wanted to say a little bit about, about how I think this works. There are a lot of ways to talk about how this works, but here's one way. I think that what we're doing today, right now, but what we're doing every day in this temple and in temples like this is, or in communities like this of all kinds, some of them are in temples, is we're creating a kind of space or a kind of field with our sincerity and with our effort. And it's a field within which each of us is able to grow and change in these particular ways. It's a space for a certain kind of maturation. And if we're lucky, it's a space for a certain kind of transformation. So we have in our tradition this whole set of practices and teachings and doctrines and texts and ceremonies and stories, a lot of really, really good stories, and images and aspirations. And all of that creates the conditions for a certain kind of change in a human being. And I wanted to think a little bit about that change, about what it is that happens in the field of our practice. You know, so maybe to start, I'll say what I don't think happens. So I don't think all our problems go away, you know. I don't think that we magically know how to get along with each other or always know what to do in any given circumstances. Probably none of you were under the impression that's what happened here, but if you were, I'm really sorry. You've been misled. That's not what happens. It's much softer and it's much more subtle. There's this great story that I came across recently in a book by Nelson Foster. It's a story about Robert Aitken. So Aitken Roshi was at a gathering of Buddhist teachers from different lineages. And he was an elder at this point, and so had been, you know, practicing devotedly for many, many decades. And someone in the audience asked him, this is such a great question, after all these years of practice, what's your mind like? And Aitken Roshi said, oh, it's a mess. But you should have seen it before. It's really good, right? It's a mess, but you should have seen it before. Like that's, there's something in that about the way we change or the way we grow in practice. The mess doesn't go away exactly, but something happens. Something really does happen, and it's really valuable. All right. So I'm thinking about this question of how we change, how we grow, or how we're transformed by a a field of sincere practice at a temple like this one. And I want to start by telling an old story, and it's a little bit dense, but I think it's worth feeling our way into it if we go slowly. So bear with me. This is an old story in our tradition. So a sincere monk goes to visit a teacher. This is in China. Many centuries ago, the teacher's named Zhang Jing, and our monk, our main character here, enters, circles the teacher's seat three times, shakes his staff, and stands there at attention. So I just want to say this is pretty good. Like, this is in these old stories, what's happening is, students and teachers, or sometimes students and students, or sometimes teachers and teachers, or sometimes who you think is going to be the teacher turns out to be the student, are talking about reality. Always talking about reality. They're talking about how things truly are. And our monk here, I think, has some understanding, is demonstrating reality. Knows enough, and I don't know how hard won this insight was. It can take us a really long time to really get to feel that we're a part of reality. You know, that we belong to reality. So if we're going to talk about reality, I'm going to walk around your seat three times. I'm going to stand here. I'm showing you reality, right? It's pretty good. It's pretty good. And John Cheng thought it was pretty good too, the teacher, because he says, right. You know, so our guy's kind of pleased, you know? A little later, he goes to another teacher, Nanchuan. And this is maybe, I don't know. Let's see what you guys think about this. He circles the teacher's seat three times. He shakes his staff and he stands there at attention. So I don't know, you know. Do you get to go back to the same well? I don't know. Anyway, Nanchuan says wrong. So the first time Zhang Jing is right. The second time Nanchuan says wrong. And the monk says, Zhang Jing said right. You know, the other guy liked it. Like, why do you say wrong? Goes, circles, right. Goes, circles, wrong. The monk says, Zhang Jing said right. Why do you say wrong? Nanchuan said, Zhang Jing is right. It's you who is wrong. This is something that can be blown by the power of the wind. Finally, it turns bad. This is something that can be blown by the power of the wind. Finally, it turns bad. So this is a complicated story, and a lot is happening here. Like all our old stories, it's really dense with meaning, really dense. But the thread that I want to tug at here is that the monk seems to be a little bit tripped up by one teacher saying right and the other teacher saying wrong. You know, it's kind of like, how can you say wrong? The other guy said right. That's sort of the feeling I have, right? There's a little stuckness there. Hong Zhe, the great Tian Tong, a really important teacher in our lineage, says about this story, right and wrong, watch out for the trap. It's like there's a trap here with this one approved, this one disapproved, and our monk gets maybe a little stuck there. You could say the trap is approval and disapproval. It feels like there's a little glitch, or there's something that doesn't just flow that the monk seems to think, well, if it was right for Zhangjiang, it should be right for Nanchuan. Because it was like this yesterday, it should be like this today. You're maybe resisting a little bit, maybe not completely able to let go or to open up to, you know, the great ceaseless mystery, the flow of now it's right, now it's wrong. Can you continue to stay with it? And in this story, it seems like he gets a little bit jammed up, you know? Right and wrong, watch out for the trap. Seems like maybe the trap got him. And the way he's caught in the trap is that he's blown around by the wind. He's blown around by the wind. Let's see, what does Nanchuan say? Nanchuan says, Zhangjiang is right, it's you who is wrong. This is something that can be blown by the power of the wind. Finally, it turns bad. It's getting blown around by the wind. So I want to notice we haven't gotten yet to the part that's about transformation. Right? We haven't gotten yet to the part that's about what can happen for us if we're lucky in a field of sincere practice. What we have so far is we have a monk, we have a person who, I think to be fair, really has some ability to demonstrate the Dharma. I'm really moved by that. Let's talk about reality. Here's reality. But also seem to get a little bit stuck wanting yesterday's move to work today, you know? So this is a story about a teacher maybe reflecting to a student where he's stuck. And, you know, my hope for all of us is that we get to see where we're stuck. We get to see the little places where we jam up. So the wind is the problem, right? The wind is blowing him around. The wind of right and wrong, the wind of approval and disapproval. And so here's the good part. I'm so excited about this part. some of you will know this right away. So this monk who's being blown around by the wind is a Magu or Mayu. Which is a mountain, that's a place. And his name is Baoshe, Mayu Baoshe. And that matters a lot because we have this other beautiful story that's really familiar to a lot of us about this monk later in his life. So when he's a student, he's getting blown around by the wind. Finally, it turns bad. But then he stays in a field of practice for some amount of time, and then we get this story. Zen Master Baoshe of Mount Mayu was fanning himself. A monk approached and said, Master, the nature of wind is permanent, and there is no place it does not reach. Why then do you fan yourself? Although you understand that the nature of wind is permanent, Baoshe replied, you do not understand the meaning of its reaching everywhere. What is the meaning of its reaching everywhere? Asked the monk. The master just kept fanning himself. The monk bowed deeply. It's a really famous story for us because it's Dogen references this story in Genjo Koan. Zen Master Baoshe of Mount Mayu was fanning himself. A monk approached and said, Master, the nature of wind is permanent, and there is no place it does not reach. Why then do you fan yourself? Although you understand that the nature of wind is permanent, you do not understand the meaning of its reaching everywhere. What is the meaning of its reaching everywhere? Baoshe just fans himself. So, I think this is such a big deal. What does it say about the nature of our practice that someone who is blown around by the wind becomes someone who fans himself. Because you might think if your problem is wind, you got to get out of the wind. You got to get away from the wind. You need to go inside or something. Live somewhere that it doesn't, that's not windy, right? Wind is the problem. But he fans himself, which means that you're intimate with wind. It means that you participate in wind. You engage or you express wind. Something that's a problem becomes something that you are working with or are connected to in some way. And for me, at least, that really feels like that's what the invitation of our practice is. I learned how to drive when I was a teenager in the Midwest. We lived in Chicago. And so I learned how to drive on ice, on snow and ice. And then I drove a lot, like in my 20s, for some years, I drove one of those big recycling trucks. You know, dump the big dumpsters. And I definitely had some challenges driving those big trucks on ice in the winter in Chicago. But some of you know, those of you that have driven on snow and ice, you know how to do it. Like, you know what you're supposed to do when you start to slide, right? You turn into the skid. You turn into the skid. You don't fight against the difficulty or the problem or the challenge, because that actually makes things way worse. It's actually really dangerous. You actually start to spin out and you damage other people when you're fighting against what's happening. But if you can go with it, actually, it's safer. It's wiser. It's more skillful. So I thought maybe we could say that our practice is to always turn into the skid, you know? And we're always skidding. Whatever it is that's happening in our life, whatever the conditions are, that's precisely the ground of our liberation. In the kind of Tibetan layer of our tradition, the Indo-Tibetan layer, a lot of you are familiar with these Lojong slogans, these little pithy mottos that you kind of carry around with you or you meditate on. And there's one Lojong slogan that says, whatever you meet is the path. Whatever you meet is the path. It sounds a lot like turn into the skid. It sounds a lot like if your problem is wind, you know, get a fan. Like, work with it in some way. Get close to it in some way. So I want to suggest that this is the great gift that can happen in our lives in a field of practice like this one, is that we can see, if we're lucky, and with the help of the people around us, that whatever we meet is the path. Maybe one more story. So whatever you meet is the path is really wonderful, and that's in the kind of Indo-Tibetan style. And usually in our tradition, really is we tell stories. We do it in stories. So there's another story. A monk asked the priest Kan Feng, the Bhagavats of the Ten Directions. Bhagavats is an epithet of the Buddha, the honored one or blessed one. So the Buddha, the highest beings. The Bhagavats of the 10 directions have one straight road to nirvana. I wonder where that road is. Kanfeng lifted up his staff, drew a line in the air, and said, here it is. All the Buddhas have one straight road to nirvana. I wonder where it is. Here it is. The road is right here, of course. Always. Where else could it be? Whatever we meet is the path. I think I want to say just maybe one more thing, if that's okay. And then I want to hear from some of you. So there is a particular kind of field that we make together that makes this kind of change possible. And we make it with our sincerity. We make it with our effort. And really, one of the ways we make it, one of the central ingredients of it, is our vow. We make it with our vow. And I've been thinking lately that there's a really important distinction between a promise and a vow. And I think a promise is when I say I'm going to do something, and I know how to do it, and I know I can do it. So if I promise you something, I understand it and I have a plan. If I promise to pick you up at the airport, I should know when your flight's getting in, and I should know where the airport is, and I should have a car, and I should know how to drive, and I should have that day off work, right? All those things need to be true for me to promise to pick you up at the airport. It would actually be really rude to say I'm going to pick you up at the airport and actually not know what an airport is and not know where it is and never have seen an airplane and not know how to drive and not have a car. So don't... That's a friendship wrecker, you know, don't do that. But in the realm of vow, that's exactly how a vow works. A vow is just naked, raw, wanting. I want to pick you up at the airport. I don't know where an airport is. I don't know how I'm going to get there. I don't know when you get there. But I want to. That's a vow. So we shouldn't mix them up because it's really bad manners to vow to pick someone up at the airport. It doesn't work. But they're different realms, actually. Necessarily a vow is that I don't know how to do it. I want to do it, and I don't know how. So that's how we make the field, to build a culture of wisdom and compassion. I really want to do it. I really want to do it, and I don't know how. That's a vow. Vows come from sincere aspiration. Vows come from yearning. Our vows come from our yearning that we want to, and we don't know how. And so we want to become the kinds of beings that might know how. And that's how we make this field. It's how we make this field together. There's a really important text in our tradition called the Brahmasnet Sutra. And it's been on my mind, actually, because there's a group of folks here that is beginning to sew their rakasus in preparation for lay ordination, where you will receive the Bodhisattva precepts. And this is the text that our Bodhisattva precepts come from, the Brahmasnet Sutra. It's this Chinese text. It has this kind of complicated history, how it got to Japan and why it's our, but our 16 precepts come from this text. And there's this section in this text about yearning. So this is what the Buddha says. My disciples, you should vow and vow with great yearning, with total yearning. Because of this yearning mind, one is released from countless bonds of views. Because of this yearning mind, innumerable marvelous practices are brought to completion. The innumerable merits of Bodhi, awakening, take yearning as their root. Yearning is the root of awakening. Did you know this? I didn't know this until I read this in the Dharma Sutra. Take yearning as their root. One first arouses a yearning mind, and in the middle one cultivates the way. As your practices complete your vow, you will directly attain Buddhahood. Giving rise to various views is not liberating wisdom. This is the essence of the vow, the origin of all practices. My disciples, you should vow and vow with great yearning, with total yearning. The innumerable merits of Bodhi take yearning as their root. So yearning is I want to and I don't know how. I want to wake up with all beings and I don't know how. I want to transform a culture of cruelty into a culture of compassion and I don't know how. That's a vow, that's yearning. And because I want to and I don't know how, there's a kind of patience and a kind of humility. And because it's a shared undertaking, in that field of vow, we create the conditions that make it possible more and more for us to turn towards the world as it really is and ourselves as we really are. And it makes it possible for us to wake up together. And so that's what we're doing. And that's what we're doing today. And that's what we're doing every day that we're here. And that's really great. Well, I think I'm gonna stop and I'm gonna ask if there are thoughts or questions or reflections. Either in the room or online. Yeah, Marley.
Thank you for this talk and for tying those two stories, which I knew independently but had not made the connecting the dots.
Yeah, it's the same person.
The dots. And one thing that struck me about seeing those together is they're also two stories, even the later story is doing the same physical gesture twice, but somehow he's figured out how to have the right, I don't know, comic timing. So I guess, you know what? I got a million questions, but I'll leave it to the next person. Thank you.
Thank you, Marley. But I guess I really appreciate that I think where you're pointing to, in a way, it's like the change, like Baoshe is still Baoshe. You know, I don't know, maybe Baoshe is a dancer. Baoshe likes doing stuff with his body, like showing stuff physically. That's still true, right? Eiken Roshi's mind is still a mess. Like, we get to be exactly how we are, and there's some intimacy with our lives, intimacy with what the problem was that is possible. So yeah, I appreciate you. I hadn't made that connection, the physicality in both stories. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Hacks.
Thank you.
Yeah.
thank you for your talk this morning. I appreciated that you sort of alluded to this sort of magical transformation. And this idea of change and people changing. And I'm curious, for me, there's a tension there in our times now where I kind of look around and I go, oh, I don't like any of this. I want to change it. And then also times where I can't really change any of this. What can I change here? And kind of both are like, I don't know, I think both are important, because if I was only preoccupied with, well, I can't do anything here, only be here, I feel like I'd miss, I feel like there's something missed. At the same time, I think I'm also missing something if I'm only concerned with the external, but what can I change? So I'm just curious about that tension of change, change internal, external, balancing those.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. And I think the wisdom of our practice would be kind of it's sort of like inside and outside are none of my business. They create each other. So like our job is to practice compassion, and is that inside or outside? I don't know. Like, I guess start somewhere if you want. You start outside and then it flows back to inside, or you start inside and it flows to outside. Like inside and outside are creating each other. Like self and world arise together. So are you working on yourself? Are you working on the world? Yes. You know? Because again, you get to be part of the, you're part of the world. I think sometimes we can think it's a little bit, we have to decide what we're gonna do. And I guess in a way, yeah, kind of where to emphasize or where you start, that's fair. And that's maybe conditions or temperament or, I don't know. But any change we make to the outside changes us, and any change to us changes the outside, you know? So it's all together. Does that make sense?
Thank you.
I just want to see if there's anyone online. You could raise a hand. Yeah, Patrick.
Okay, I'm doing what I'm doing. I was kind of hoping the mic would run out before it got to me. Because I know I'm going to get this wrong.
Yeah.
But I'll go ahead anyway, because the wind's blowing. It's pretty still, though. It's pretty still in this room.
Yeah.
You can feel it.
Yeah.
It's unusually still. The flames on the candle are going straight up, as far as I can see. And I can see a little bit from the outside. On the outside, I don't see the branches of trees moving much. So where's the wind reaching right now?
If we're lucky enough to enter spaces together with no wind, we can just put our fan down, you know?
Is that what you're doing now?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick.
Dave, thanks so much for your talk and for the conversation. What's in my heart at the moment that relates to all of this is there's a lot of conversation about what it means to be in solidarity right now, and the languaging shifting from being an ally to being in solidarity. And one of the definitions I heard of that is that your life isn't much at stake as the one you're in solidarity with, that is the enactment of waking up together. And so what connects in that conversation that I've been hearing is what it means to show up. So for instance, the relationship of righteous anger to fierce compassion. If you go to a protest and the messaging or the energy is let's say filled with righteous rage, outrage, and there's messaging that can come across as othering. So how how does what you're speaking to today support us in showing up in that wind and enacting our vow that leaves no one out?
Judy, I appreciate that. I think I was really moved to come across this passage in the Brahma's Net Sutra about yearning. And so I think wanting without knowing how is a really powerful place to be. So we want compassion and clarity, and we don't want to fall into hatred and anger. And maybe we don't know how exactly. So, you know, you go and you show up and you do your best. So for me, there's something really moving about staying with the wanting and not necessarily having a plan in advance. Because that again is, you know, that's the world of picking people up at airports, which is awesome. But we're up to something a little bit different. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think Jerry had her hand up.
Thanks a lot for the talk. It reminded what I wanted to talk about was the repetition of the same action.
Uh-huh.
You basically can't repeat the same action, first of all. But in my work as a pediatrician, when a kid gets approval for something, they just shine, and they want to do it, and they just want to do it all the time.
Yeah.
And they do it in any kind of circumstance just to get the approval.
Yeah.
So there's something about that we all have that child needing approval from our teacher. And so, of course, you're going to try, it works.
Yeah.
I want approval now. So that's just some kind of a and that would be the kind way of looking at it. The other way is, you know, people have egos, and they're really practicing, and they get attached to the ego thing of being approved, and so they do it the next time, they're not doing it out of spontaneity or appropriateness of what's going on right now. It's not skillful means anymore. It's an action with a self-interest behind it. And you know, we try to be present in each moment and give what's coming up sincerely in the context of that moment. And you can't learn how to do that by practicing the same thing over and over.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. Thanks for unpacking that part of the koan. And again, Bausha was really lucky to have where he's stuck reflected to him. So he could go off and study it for who knows how long, you know, and then figure out how to fan, you know. So thanks to all of you. Please show me where I'm stuck, you know. Thank you so much. And then I'll know, yeah, I'll kind of know the next thing to work with, you know, like, oh yeah, I did. I really wanted to be right, you know. And it's like, all right, I can work with that. Like, it's all workable. I think you said the kindness, that's the kind eyes. Like, it's all work. Of course we're stuck, you know, but it's workable. It's workable. Yeah.
A lot of gratitude for your talk. And the Berkeley Zen Center and all the people in it. You know, this might feel like it resonates with you, but you know, it's my feeling that maybe rare is the person who arrives at the gate on a really solid winning streak, you know?
Yeah, it's fair.
And to arrive and surrounded by people who are yearning for like how to accept what is unfolding in front of them as their life and the way, is a wonderful opportunity. And so I have a lot of gratitude for any place that, you know, helps people turn towards what is most difficult and make that the way, or have an understanding that that actually is the way, you know, instead of turning towards everything else that might, you know, help you numb how you feel about everything as it unfolds in front of you. I thank you for helping clarify yearning, and I think that the distinction between a promise and a vow was beautiful. And I vow to try and understand it. It's perfect.
Yeah. Me too.
Yeah, Tom. Yeah, thank you for your words and for the images of driving in snow and ice.
Yeah.
I grew up in St. Louis and had more than one time skidding out, hitting trees. And, but the part I'm just reflecting on now is when someone got stuck in the snow, speaking of getting stuck, they just hit the accelerator, the tires just spin. But then what happens in the Midwest, I'm sure all over the world, people stop and jump out of their car and push you out. And that felt so good to be able to do that for somebody. Yeah, my relatives in Minnesota, they shovel each other's driveways. There's a shared purpose and shared helping that we don't have so much here with this favorable weather.
So, yeah. It's too easy, you know? That's the problem. Yeah, well, good. And maybe then things can get harder for us and we can be kinder to each other. That's a great image. I really love that. And it's really true. Yeah, people get you out and you... you got to work your way out, right? There's that like back and forth thing you got to do. Yeah, that's really good. Someone else give a talk about that, because that's really good. I don't know what it means yet, but that's great. Tom, you give a talk on that. I think we have time maybe for one more comment or question, or we could stop now and go have tea. Yeah, Joe.
Thanks, Dave. In regards to Blanche's quote, sometimes that support feels abstract. Like, of course it's there. Of course I don't exist without everyone else. So what's disappointment?
Yeah, disappointment is maybe wanting the support to look different, right?
Thank
you.
Yes, please.
Thank you for supporting me in this way. Mm-hmm. I actually was hoping you would support me in another way. You know, that's fair. That's fair. That happens a lot. And so, again, you know, the yearning, what we want, and I don't know how, is, you know, may I feel all of your support as the support it is. May I support you in the way I most want to. And I don't know how, you know. And so in the meantime, we're going to mess up and we're going to kind of bug each other.
That's a helpful perspective. Thanks.
Thank you, too.